And that was Dinah Washington with Rich Man's Blues. Before that was Blows Top Blues, then Embraceable You and Pacific Coast Blues. And we'll have our final closing theme here.
What a time, what a warm and wondrous time, so sweet a shining moment in the sun. Oh, what a time, was there ever such a time, then suddenly it's done, the moment passes.
Time is almost up. Thanks for listening to Big Band Broadway and Beyond. God bless, and if anybody asks, tell them Joe sent you.
Must we let it end?
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn.
And now it's time for the new WHFR Journal, coming from the Dearborn Farmers Market.
Yes.
Jay, come on in.
Yes, here we are. Thank you, Joe. We are live from the Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market, our special live outdoor version of the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. I'm here with General Manager Susan McGraw. And also, our first special guest today in this political season is Senator David Kinesic from the Garden City and other contiguous areas, which happens to be Susan McGraw's home turf. So let's turn it over to Susan McGraw for our interview with Senator Kinesic, who graciously came down today in his fashion. And he, of course, remembered me because obviously his whole career got started because of the WHFR bump. We know that that's true, of course. No, not necessarily. But here it is. Here's the microphone, Susan.
Thank you, Jay. It's a pleasure to be subbing on your show a little bit today. And just by looking at you today, Senator Kinesic, in your comfortable clothing and we're outdoor at a beautiful farmer's market. If you don't mind, I'm going to call you David. Welcome to the show.
I'm very happy to be here, and I'm more than okay with that. Yeah.
All right. Very good. Jay mentioned Garden City. There are a few other communities that you represent. Tell us exactly who your constituents are.
So I represent the 5th Senate District, and that is Northwest Detroit, all of Redford Township, all of Dearborn Heights, all of Garden City, and all of Inkster.
Very good. There's a lot of people to be working for.
about 270,000. It's a good district, though. I mean, it's one of the most diverse districts that we have in the state, so I think it presents some really unique challenges, but also some really unique opportunities as well. So I like it. It keeps me on my toes.
Very good. Well, just a little bit of background on you before we jump into some of the heavier issues of the day. We know that you have college experience with U of M and another school in the state, I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
My freshman year, yeah.
Oh, very good. And it's an interesting story how you sort of got into the political component, but basically it was on a challenge or a dare from someone that was already in office. But how has the experience been crossing that line into a political career?
No, it's been incredibly eye-opening in a number of ways, just incredibly frustrating in a number of others. But more often than not, it's a very rewarding job. And I think that comes from, you know, maintaining really close ties to the community, never forgetting who it was that sent you to Lansing in the first place, and giving an opportunity to the community to hold you accountable for what it is that you're doing. Somebody asked me the other day, you know, hear all these stories, negative stories coming out of Lansing. Do you ever get, you know, disillusioned or what have you? And I don't think I get disillusioned so much as I do getting incredibly frustrated, because sometimes the answer seems so obvious, the writing seems to be right in front of your face, but people let politics get in the way of their decision-making process, and you get an even worse result than you would have gotten otherwise. So I think it's just incumbent upon, you know, other good folks, common sense folks. I think common sense is not a common virtue in Lansing. Just to keep pushing and to realize that the more people that we get into office that think like us, that are passionate like us, that have a work ethic like us, the better the outcomes are going to be permanent.
That's just a good keyword there. Common sense, logic, intelligence. You didn't mention that one, but that will slow that one in as well. I'm studying at college here. What did you get your degree in,
Lansing? So my degree is in political science from the University of Michigan, Dearborn. And so I graduated in November of 2012, got elected in November 2012, graduated December 2012, and got sworn to office in January of 2013.
Wow, how exciting. We'll talk a little bit more about that first official year in office. But first, and this is a somber tone of discussion in my district and yours as well, we lost the wonderful, wonderful gal, Julie Pilecki, and it's tragic and shocking as it is, because we, on the outside, always enjoy sort of following her and reading things about her and that she's standing up for and so on. We know that tragic loss has affected some things moving forward for CCC Build, and not only short-term, but also moving into the year. What's happening with that?
So you've got two different elections that you're going to be looking at November, really. And the first one is going to be fill the last 2 months of her current term, so November and December of 2016. Some folks would say, well, why fill it for the last 2 months? The reality is, you know, the lame duck period is one of the most important periods of the entire session, and so it is important that we get somebody representing the 9,000 people of the 11th House District. Only one person has filed to run on the Democratic side, and only one person has filed to run on the Republican side for that election to fill the last 2 months. I will tell you, it's an overwhelmingly Democratic district. The Democrat will win. And the good news is that her daughter, Lauren, has filed to take her mom's spot and to carry on her mother's legacy for the last 2 months of this year. And so I look forward to working with her in the legislature. But for the term beginning January 1st, we had to go through a very legal process of bringing together all the precinct delegates from the 11th House District. They selected a panel of three judges to interview candidates who wanted to appear on the ballot start for the January 1st term, and those individuals on the panel selected Inkster City Councilman Duell Jones to be on the ballot. Again, he's the only Democrat on the ballot. He will win the election in November, and he will be our new state representative from January 1st. So after working with Lauren, I look forward to working with Duell as well.
A lot of young energy, you know, and I'm looking at young energy right in front of me, but that's, 20 years old?
I feel sorry. Joel's 21. Okay. If you add up he and I's age come January 1st, I think we'll be 25 years younger than the oldest member of the legislature right now. And so, you know, with that, you know, young age, some people, you know, want to use it as a negative against you. What I have found, more people see it as a net positive because you've got a completely different perspective. You look at issues through a different lens. And it's kind of work ethic that is really just insatiable. And you want to be at everything in the community. You want to be working, you know, sort of the system of the land to make sure that you can deliver on behalf of your residents. And so, you know, you also realize as a young person, you're coming into it with a different skill set. And maybe you don't have that sort of vocal experience that other politicians might have, but you're humble enough to admit that to yourself. And you're willing to work, go above and beyond in order to sort of level that playing field.
Yeah, what we've seen with you, at least in the first year, and what we're hoping with Ralph as well as will be an interest and a passion to stand your ground against some of the big guys, the veterans, because I think that they might see this as an opportunity to a little, you know, up appearance. So you've been pretty good with that, and You're gonna
help the others, right? Yeah, I mean, a lot of folks, you know, when I was young, took a chance on me. I got elected when I was 26, and so I see it as really an obligation to get forward to, you know, other young people that want to get involved in politics. And I'll tell you, I mean, you really hit the nail on the head. Some of the folks that are, you know, the old-timers, if you will, the saltier, you know, politicians up there, you know, they have a young guy or a young girl come into the system, they definitely try to push you around a little bit. All it takes is one good, you know, putting your foot down or pushing back or telling them that that is not how you're going to be, you know, treated when you come to town, and that your vote and your voice is equal to theirs. You represent the same amount of people as they do. It doesn't matter. Democrat or Republican, you were elected by the people of your district. You have an obligation to stand up to them. And so, you know, sometimes the salty ones try and push you around. They really just want to see if you're going to stand up for yourself. And the second you do, they know they've got a good fighter.
That's good news. Speaking of good news, and the opposite of that, bad news, it's been a tough year trying to move things forward and so on, but give us a brief summary of what you see as the highlights in both directions.
You know, for me personally, one of the best things that we had come out of the legislature last year was the tax bills that I'd written, bicameral tax bills, aimed at updating the service dogs laws that we have here in the state of Michigan so we can help veterans who suffer from post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury. Those were signed into law by Governor Snyder. We've completely come into line with the ADA, and Michigan is now on the forefront of helping veterans who want to make a healthy transition back home. For me, one of the most frustrating things really was the roads package that we had last year. It's not enough money. It doesn't get implemented until 6 years down the road, and it does so at the expense of working class, you know, average sort of folks in the state of Michigan. Every year you go to renew that license, you're going to get hit with higher fees. You go to put gas in the tank, you're going to get hit with higher gas taxes. We're asking the people who have already sacrificed so much to continue to pick up the bill for state government. It's really frustrating for me on a personal level, and certainly for my position.
Moving forward, you've just given, I think, a reason for people to be active, make their vote count, et cetera, not only in the actual election itself, but in the primaries. Why is that so important, not only typical, but especially right now, for people to stay active?
You know, you cannot deny the fact that you have significant gerrymandering that's taking place within the state of Michigan. For 110 houses or seats in the House of Representatives, 100 of them are decided on the primary election day because they're drawn to be so overwhelmingly Democratic or Republican. If you don't participate in the primary, you're really not participating at all. And so, you know, I tell folks all the time, if you don't have a seat at the table, you're just on the bench. Your vote is your voice. Do not give your voice away to somebody else. And so the only way that you can get bad people out of office is if you participate in the process. If you don't vote, it's really difficult for you to complain after the fact about the people that were sent to office if you didn't participate.
All right. Great talk, great words of advice, and keep up the good fight, David. It was a pleasure talking.
The pleasure is mine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Give it back to you, Jay. Thanks again.
Thank you, Susan McGraw. Thank you, Senator David Kinesic, who is effectively the spokesperson for the whole Democratic Party in Michigan. I mean, I know you're a head chair of the Democratic Caucus in Michigan Senate, but I've heard you on the radio talking about, boy, almost everything, anything happening anywhere in the world, what's the Michigan Democratic spin, and there you are. So thanks for volunteering. Did you volunteer, or was it a short stick that they pulled out of a hat or something?
Sometimes
great job communicating what the Democratic Party is trying to do and good luck in all the elections. I know you're supporting certain candidates, and we're going to continue now with another candidate for 15th District Michigan Representative. And coming right up, they're just swapping chairs. We're playing musical chairs out here. If you're wondering about background sounds, yes, we are live from Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market. All right, so I'm switching sides here, and there's hugs going on. And you want to, well, me there. Okay, well, Susan, sit here. Okay.
All right.
Brian Stone.
Sure.
Brian Stone is one of the Democratic candidates for office who's on the primary election ballot. That's August 2nd, folks. And there's a lot of choice. There are six people. I do want to sort of announce before we do the interview, and Brian will get his full 30 minutes here. And to be fair, the same questions we ask the other candidates for this office. I'm fighting the wind here just for a second. But I wanted to mention that I heard from the League of Women Voters people today that one of the candidates on the ballot for the 15th District Michigan Democratic Representative, Alex Shamey, has had heart problems and some sort of specific health problem. I think they mentioned heart problems, and that effectively he told them that effectively he is ending his campaign. So, I just wanted to tell voters to consider that if you were thinking of voting for him. He has been in other races in Dearborn and maybe supported him at that time. So if he doesn't feel that even if elected, he could serve at this point, just want to let you know whatever that means. But there's six candidates, and so we're continuing here. We have four of the six, including Brian, on the show, continuing, of course, next week and the week after with a couple more. Well, welcome to the new WHFR Journal, Brian Stone. Tell our people a little bit about your background, which includes education, employment, and family.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me here. I think the real basic part of it is that when I returned home from serving overseas in the Navy, I found out that they were charging veterans out-of-state tuition here in Michigan. And they were charging them this at several of our major universities, including Michigan State and the University of Michigan. And so this was part of the reason I got involved in politics so shortly after returning home. And we had a lot of different people that had tried to deal with this issue, but eventually they just gave up. And so what I did is I organized veterans across the state. I raised the issue with legislators and with the media, and we were able to get a bill put forward. And even though it wasn't passed, it gave the pressure that we needed to be able to get the universities to acquiesce to our demands. And so now every major university in Michigan gives in-state tuition to veterans. And after that, I got really active in our local Dearborn Democratic Club. I'm currently the communications chair there. And then also with the 12th Congressional District Democratic Party, of which I am actually the youngest board of trustees. And so really came from this from a very grassroots standpoint and taking a stand on issues. And then, of course, my writing for the Huffman Post, where I've been a big advocate for Dearborn. And some of my articles, like What If America Looked Like Dearborn, Michigan, have been very popular. Yeah. And a lot of Dearborn residents have sent it out to relatives that maybe have misconceptions about our city.
So with that first taste of definitely some success there, you see how politics is done. And it in a way, it's not too hard, but it takes the time and energy, and you got to figure it out first, too. Exactly who do you talk to when, and what is it they need from you to make them come to your side or whatever. And politics is not an easy game to get into. So educational background?
Yeah, I have a degree from the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and I also have my associate's degree with Coastline Community College. Both are communications degrees. At U of M, my minor was in applied statistics, and so I figure, communications is where most people lie, and then statistics is the other half of where everybody lies in Lansing. So I figure it'll help me out in making sure that nobody can fool me. And I think really what I'm proud of is that I actually got my associate's degree while serving overseas. Mm-hmm. And
Coastline is, they have a lot of online classes.
Yeah, and they're very military friendly because they give you credits for your military experience and the training that you've received, which is something that I really think more of our colleges and universities need to jump onto because, for instance, I received 6 months of training in everything from photography to broadcast journalism to public relations and print journalism, graphic design, and all of these are often required courses in a communications field, and I think our colleges and universities would really be well to take that into account so that our veterans aren't coming back and basically taking the same class twice.
I'm not sure if I introduced you fully to Susan McGraw here, not only general manager of our radio station, but she's also the full-time head of the telecommunication and journalism program, and it's area coordinator is the official title, right, Susan? So are you going to use Brian for endorsements for telecom majors going into politics from now on?
You've been reading my mind, yeah. Matthew. The wheels are turning, absolutely. No,
well, I was just going to say that before our current major, John B. O'Reilly Jr., Mayor Michael Guido was mayor for 16 years or so before he unfortunately died in office. But you know, he was a major from Wayne State in the communications area, too. And I should just tell people, well, communications, that's just using telephones properly or giving public address. No, it's critical thinking a lot. You know, it's actually understanding what's going on in the world and trying to sort it out logically and present it in a variety of media, too, because you don't do on the telephone what you might do in a print article. And obviously, you've done several different media, so you know you maybe just instinctively the differences there. So sounds like a pretty good background so far. And I know I wanted to mention, too, and I think you should, the number of community groups that you participate with. I saw you mentioned in the Arab American News that you were also one of the regular participants in the sort of a meals program, inner-city meals program with Julie Bulecki, who recently died, and I was talking about her on the show with Senator Kinesic. So you've done a lot of that, too. You've really gotten involved here. And of course, that's always good to get your name out there, but it's so important to do that, too. Tell me a little bit how you got so involved.
Well, you know, I think the Navy kind of got me hooked on humanitarian service and aid. When I was serving, you know, there were a lot of opportunities where we would pull into port in different countries and we would be, you know, pulling people's teeth or giving them crowns or maybe giving them shots and vaccinations. There were times we would paint school walls or, you know, just clear up the yard for different charities. And these kinds of things were really helpful because we could do manual labor that maybe they needed. And so I always used to really love participating in that. And I'd always bring my camera and take photographs of the other sailors doing it. And so actually people even search like U.S. Navy, Brian Stone photo, they'll find tons of photographs of other people who are doing humanitarian service because I was publishing a lot of those photos. And so, you know, I kind of caught the bug then, and I did get a humanitarian service medal for a lot of my effort, as well as for working in the response to the 2011 tsunami, earthquake, nuclear disaster in the east side of Japan.
Oh, really?
And so after I came back home, I think I just kind of felt like I was missing out because I wasn't doing enough. So a friend of mine, Nahid Ayub, who runs Project Igni Outreach, which is this great program, she goes out and she makes sure that the homeless get a good meal every Sunday. And one of the nice things about her program that's so special is that a lot of church groups will kind of come and go and they want to do something good, but they don't really have the ability to sustain it every day. But Nahid is the master of the guilt trip. She will make sure that business owners give every week and that they give good stuff. You know, there was, for instance, there was a really great offering where the owner of Mango's gave, I think it was like 100 sub sandwiches. And, you know, normally when somebody donates food, they donate the regular stuff. Well, no, they donated buffalo chicken sandwiches and stuff like that. So they were given the good stuff. And so one of the things about Project Dignity that I love is that they really make sure that we feed the homeless we would see them if they were a part of our own family. And they are. We're all one human family. And so Julie was really active in that, and so was her husband, Mark. And I think that it's just a really wonderful community of us that goes out there. And it's been one of the more fun things that I've been able to do since coming back and serving overseas.
Well, just from the summary of your background, I think I get an idea why you're running for this office, because politics is what makes a lot of things happen, or it can anyway. But as a Democrat, it's going to be awfully difficult. Don't you see that as an almost impossible challenge? I mean, the Democrats in the last year, Senator Kinesis, have been missing some of the major initiatives. Nothing passed. Few of them couldn't even get out of committee or get even heard by committees because of the Republican majorities. What approach are you going to use there? Just see the noble opposition and talk a lot? I mean, it seems kind of frustrating right now because of Republican majorities in House and Senate and the governor's race. Of course, November election could change some of the House and Senate numbers, but not necessarily. That's going to be kind of frustrating, isn't it?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, we do need to focus on making sure that we get a Democratic majority in the State House this year. And I personally told Tim Grimmel, the House Minority Leader, that should I be so fortunate as to make it through this primary with the Democratic nomination, I will be working my butt off to make sure that other Democrats get elected in other State House seats, because we need those safe sort of seat Democrats where they're in majority Democratic areas to work hard and make sure that other Democrats get elected during the general election. And so that's one area where I can control that, and that's something that I know I can make a difference on. As far as the policy side, you know, all I can say is I think there are some examples of really successful people. For instance, State Senator Steve Bia, who's an incredible person, a mentor of mine, and a good friend, he just recently got a Republican to put forward the legislation for the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Amendment. So basically, they're adding sexual orientation and gender identity into the list of non-discrimination protections. He got Republicans to lead on this. And he's the maker, he's the person who put forward the bill, but he's got a number of Republican Senate co-sponsors. It's been making big headlines. And so I think it's just a matter of how you work with people. And, you know, to be honest, I guess I have a little bit of a flair for taking on impossible causes. I think if somebody said back in 2013 that I would be able to get U of M to give up $29 million a year for no apparent reason to veterans, people would probably say I was crazy. When Michigan State did it, I think people were even more surprised. But if you're tenacious and you're on the right side of the truth, and you know how to communicate it to the public, and you have the ability to bring the public on your side, then I think the politicians will follow.
You seem to know your own mind pretty well, and you seem to have strength of character, at least in your communications. But, you know, the last couple of representatives for the 15th District that I've interviewed, off the record, sometimes on the record on my shows, they said in that first term, the Democratic Party just tells me how to vote, and then the lobbyists tell me how to vote, too. And they sort of threaten that if I don't do what the party or the lobbyists say, then I won't get reelected because the party won't give me any money or support. So you think you're strong-minded enough to stand up to those kinds of challenges? I mean, Gary Warrenchuk, who's now our county commissioner, and a Democrat now, he was a Republican in Lansing, he said it took him 3 terms to figure out how to get something done that he actually believed in himself. Well, that's a challenge, too. Again, this is your first political office that you will have held, and you seem to have a clear vision. That'll probably help. But you think you can stand up to, you know, undue pressures from the powers that be, even the Democrats that are already in Lansing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, that's the easy part, because the truth is, you know, when we're really talking about can you stand up to the sort of machine aspect of the politics, it's, well, do you have your own money? And that's the real question, because it's about money for politicians at that point. And so I haven't really raised much money at all from political action committees. The only two political action committees that have given my campaign any money were the Dearborn Firefighters Association and the National Veterans Group VoteVets.org. And that's because I'm a Democratic veteran, and I think they've really been proud of a lot of the things my campaign is doing. So we're really not reliant on that. We've raised over $40,000 just from everyday community donations here in Dearborn, and people believe in my campaign, and they believe in me. And so they aren't going to be swayed because some third-party interest group, the insurance industry or whatever, tries to bully me. It just, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you have sources for fundraising from within your community, if you ask people for that kind of grassroots support, then you own yourself. And if you own yourself, then they can't push you around, and they know that. And so I think that's really the core of it, is making sure that you're not making compromises with yourself during the campaign, and then you don't have to make compromises with yourself as a legislator.
Let me jump on to some topics. So we got too many here for the time. We still have about 15 minutes left to talk to you, so we can extend, we can get into many of these. In terms of support for education, what do you think needs to be done? I mean, the big bill passed about support for Detroit education, but part of it was something I think is against our state constitution, and that is support for parochial education. Also, people in Detroit don't feel it's enough money, and the current board, which is going to be, I think, ousted if this gets in place, is they're raising some legal challenges even to prevent the separation in two districts. But there's education in Dearborn, too. That's an issue. So is more funding for all public education a better answer? I mean, a basic answer?
Well, I mean, I always hate it when people just say yes to things. I think we really have to look at this in depth. So first of all, as to the Detroit public schools issue, you know, one of the really nice things about Dearborn is that we take care of our lawns, and people take pride in having a nice, fresh-cut lawn. But if your neighbor's lawn is kind of getting messed up, what do? You tell them, or if you've told them and they don't do anything, you call the city, right? Well, our neighbor's lawn, as far as education goes, is getting a little bit unkempt, and the state went in and they tried to fix it. But when they came in, instead what they did is they ripped the whole thing out and left it there. And so, guess what? You know, we're going to have to fix it. And you don't want an eyesore next to your house. And we don't want to have our neighbors in Detroit to have a poor public education system. And so I think that's a really basic tenet and a part of, I think, just being a Democrat is having compassion for people like that. As to education broadly, though, I think I'm more interested in making really specific changes to the system, because I think people can talk about just more education dollars, and that is helpful. I mean, it really is. But what we need to, I think, really do is start refunding a lot of the gifted education programs and then a lot of the special education programs, because those have been the things that were cut by and large in the recession. And if you talk to teachers, and I can say this because I come from two generations of Dearborn Public Schools teachers, but if you talk to teachers, they'll tell you the middle 50% of the students are easy. It's that top 25% that are really brilliant and that you need to give them extra stuff and extra work so they can feel challenged, that are they take a lot of your time. And then the bottom 25% where you have really behavioral issues or cognitive issues, and they need extra help. And so if you have programs that address that, they do well. And I mean, even in my own self in my own educational experience here in Dearborn Public Schools, I went to Hague Elementary where they had an Ignite program for gifted kids. And then in middle school, they didn't have anything. In my freshman year of high school, they had one program, and then it dropped off in the sophomore year. And you could see with the grades where it goes up and then kind of goes down a little. And it really was because I just wasn't being engaged at my level. And so people often think that gifted kids are just going to do great because they're smart, but it's not true. They really need to be challenged. And we miss out on the wonderful things that they might create if we really challenge them and get them to exercise their talents and bring out their full potential. And that's what a good gifted children's program does. And we've been removing those statewide. And those are two things that I think could make a tangible improvement. And that's, I think, a major issue with public education, and I think it's affecting a lot more families than you realize.
Susan, why don't you check one of our topics there to ask you about?
Well, certainly. Alternative energy and the environment sort of go hand in hand, or at least they should. Those are talking points for me. I just bought my first hybrid. Very excited about that vehicle, not, you know, dog. So what are your positions on the need to think outside the box as it relates to making the energy that our communities need to be sustainable, as well as how it's going to affect the environment around us?
Yeah, you know, I think this is a really important issue, and unfortunately, I think it's become a very partisan issue when it should be very centrist. And I think part of the problem is that we really have sort of a standstill between the Chamber of Commerce and the environmental groups. And so I think one thing that I've really felt where I could add to the equation is I started looking at the problem from where the numbers are at. I guess it's the inner statistician in me. And so when you look at where the majority of the air pollution comes from, it comes from energy production in Southeast Michigan. About 82-83% of all the pollution is caused by energy production. And when you look at who's consuming the most energy, it's about 86% being used by commercial and industrial facilities. So putting in the extra light bulb, the CFL light bulb, making little improvements to your house, it can help. But in the grand scale of things, that's really not going to change much. So what I want to focus on is how do we make businesses and industry more efficient with the energy that they use? Because when we talk about efficiency, it's not going at loggerheads to an industry that's already under a lot of pressure from China and Japan and Vietnam and Indonesia and other places like that. But it allows us to achieve the goal of having cleaner air. So what I'd like to see is a green loan program. And it's actually something I'd like to model after the Veterans Home Loan Program. And what that is that the VA would basically insure a portion of your loan up to $36,000 and no more than 25%, and you get the best loan rate from it. And so it saves veterans a lot of money, and then it also requires that the bank verify you have the income to pay it off. Well, a lot of businesses right now have a hard time getting capital. So insurance, interest rates, these kinds of things cost them a lot of money. And so if they're making a capital reinvestment in an industrial facility here, for instance, even shaving a couple interest points off of what they're paying for could significantly reduce their costs tens of millions of dollars. And so through this sort of a loan mechanism, you're able to save them a significant amount of money. And then the requirement would be that they're increasing the energy efficiency per unit of production or, you know, reducing the overall air pollution that the facility creates. Another thing that could be really effective is on the small business level, doing this for commercial refrigerators, hot water heaters, and redoing insulation, because so many restaurants in our area have old commercial refrigerators that are real energy hogs. And when you give them the ability to get capital for that and at a low interest rate, it really does well. And the nice part about it is it requires a very small investment. So let's say we take $10 million, right, and we say we're going to put this $10 million up in the pool to insure these kinds of loans. Well, you can loan out up to 11 times that amount. And if you're only insuring 10 to 20% of these loans, what we're really talking about is $10 million supporting over $760 million in investment every year. And that's a good, I think, a very efficient way of getting rid of a lot of the air pollution, but also in making industry more efficient and getting industry and business reinvesting in Michigan. So it's a win-win. And I think if we're talking about the environment, we need to find win-win solutions.
Some fresh ideas there. We're talking to Brian Stone today on the WHFR Journal. This is Jake Lanek and Susan McGraw with me here at the beautiful Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market. And we're going to be including the show in about 20 minutes, and back in the studio, we'll have Highway 61 Blues for you. But let's continue on. Let's see. Well, I've got marijuana. Legalization of marijuana is one of our little topics scribbling here. What have you heard? Is there a chance to get that as a proposal on the November ballot, or do you think it's impossible now?
You know, I haven't been following up on this issue very much. I understand that they were trying to do the ballot issue, but to be honest, I think it's one of those things where the voters made their voice heard, and unfortunately, I think Republicans, in trying to get rid of the provision, have actually made it even more frustrating for residents and more difficult for law enforcement to actually enforce the law. So, you know, it's a real mess right now, and either way, I would be happy if anybody fixed it, but I haven't really looked into it that much because, frankly, people in Dearborn aren't that concerned about it when we've got issues with jobs, infrastructure, education. All of that is higher on their list of priorities than figuring out what to do with marijuana. So,
higher.
Well, it seems also that they're
higher on their
list. The legislature, again, Republican majority, that they were. They changed the time limit for circulating petitions or ballot proposals in general, I mean, now in the future. And then it seemed like it was retroactive to the petitions that were already being taken out for putting legalization of marijuana on the ballot. So, and I think they reduced it to only 180 days, and so that invalidated a bunch of signatures. And I just don't think it's good to make the ballot proposal, the petitioning system, more difficult for people if they really feel that they want to take action. Of course, the legislature is kind of infamous, in my own personal opinion. Remember, folks, on this show, all opinions are not necessarily those of Henry Ford College.
Right.
But voters clearly said they didn't like the new emergency manager law that Governor Snyder and Republicans put in place. And so they got a ballot proposal going, and they voted it down to go back to the old emergency manager provisions that was in place under Governor Granholm. And then the legislature went ahead and voted back in again and made it unable to be petitioned away by making it, they added some finance amendment to it, which means a petition can't ever take it out. So I just think it's a bad trend. That's my comment.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just a certain level of disrespect for democracy itself. On the Republican side, because they really have, in a way, corrupted the process with a lot of these different measures where they've not just circumvented the will of the people. There may, you know, part of why we have a legislature is because maybe they do know something better than the rest of us, and they should be able to exercise sound judgment in contradiction of the popular will if it's an issue where they are warranted in doing so. But this is one of those things where I think the public was right on it because it was circumventing democracy. And for them to then circumvent democracy again through this vote and the way that they did it, I think really just shows where they're part of that. And so, you know, I'm really disappointed with a lot of the things they're doing. And I think people need to understand that when you reduce the amount of time that a ballot measure can be put up and the signatures collected, what they're really doing is saying only campaigns that can afford to pay people to collect the signatures are going to be viable. And that means you need at least $10 or $12 million to do a ballot measure in Michigan. And most groups just don't have that kind of money.
And that's job creation, huh?
Well, I don't know if that's the kind of job creation we want.
It's a bad joke. Okay. but I'm just going to pick a random here. Michigan is known nationwide as being really big on prisons. I mean, we have so many people in prison in Michigan, even compared to other states. Although as a country, we have a very high percentage of people of our population in prison, too. I'll give you maybe just 2 minutes on that, and then we'll allow you a couple minutes for a summation.
Yeah, well, I think we really need to move towards a more compassionate justice system. I think part of the issue itself is that every single legislature has added new things that they think should be illegal. So when you are constantly banning all human activity, what happens is everybody goes to jail. And so we have a society where in some neighborhoods in Detroit, between 40 and 60% of the fathers have been in prison at some point in the child's life. And this is just an unsustainable trend. It's something that voters are having to pay for. And one thing that I'd like to do that I think could curb this is ensuring that when people bring up new laws where they want to make something illegal, that it has to be listed as an appropriation and that they have to say where they're going to get the money from. Because when we make things illegal, there is a cost to it. There's a cost to taxpayers in paying for people to go to prison or to go through the courts or to be arrested and for police enforcement, and that should be included in these bills. And so I think that if we start actually addressing the financial aspect of it, that will hopefully persuade some Republicans to get their head out of the sand on this get tough on everything kind of nonsense. And then the other part is just making sure that people understand that, you know, if you're trying to ban minute activities of persons, you're not really improving society and you're not stopping the activity. What you are doing is you're impacting families, and maybe that we should have more informal conflict resolution systems and have more social service support for people who are caught hurting themselves through drugs or other activities. And I think that would be a much more positive way of dealing with the majority of these issues.
Okay. Well, we're at just about at the end of the 30-minute allotment, and we're, again, it's Brian Stone, who's a Democrat and running in the primary election August 2nd for 15th District Michigan Representative. That's in the Dearborn area and a little bit outside, but pretty much it's one of those amazing districts. It's not too gerrymandered in the state of Michigan. It's, I think, 94% just Dearborn. So it's pretty unique. I mean, you can say, I represent Dearborn, and pretty much that's it. Whereas other people say, well, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and 28 other little towns. So if there's anything uniquely unifying about Dearborn, you can easily speak to it because you happen to represent all of Dearborn, if you get that far, of course. And good luck with that. Well, one thing that's always mentioned, and people, candidates work hard on this, is endorsements. So just a brief list of endorsements. Again, I always think personally that endorsements don't matter. It's just all the individual people that support you and work for you. But I know you've got endorsements, so give us a few, and then we'll give you a chance for a one-minute summary.
Yeah, I mean, I think people make their own decisions, but it never hurts to have a few endorsements. And today's actually a great day to ask the question because I just found out this morning that the Detroit News editorial board endorsed my campaign for the 15th House District. So that's a big one. Hopefully we'll hear by the end of the weekend where the Detroit Free Press and MLive are at. And so those are also really big, and I've got my fingers crossed. But I can also tell you I've been endorsed by State Representative Jeremy Moss, State Representative John Hoadley, State Senator Steve Beda, by the Dearborn Firefighters Association, which I'm particularly proud of, national groups like VoteVets.org, the National Democratic Veterans Group, the LGBT Victory Fund, which is a national LGBT civil rights group. I've also been endorsed by Ironworkers Local 25, Roofers Local 149, and the Sheet Metal Workers Local 80, so some great union support, as well as being marked as highly qualified and a women's health champion by Planned Parenthood. And I'm thinking, am I missing anything here? You get so many by the end of it that it's hard to remember it all in one sentence. But we've had quite a few endorsements, and I'm very, very proud of the whole process. Oh, I almost forgot. The Arab American and Muslim Political Action Committee's Youth Caucus endorsed my campaign. And so that was really important because they based it off of my activism on behalf of the Arab and Muslim American community. So that was really something I'm proud of. And I'm the only campaign in Dearborn that can claim to have the support of unions, first responders, veterans, women's groups, Arab Americans. That is a list of endorsements that looks like Dearborn. And so while endorsements may not get votes, what I can say is that the mix looks like the place I'm trying to represent, and that I'm very proud and happy about.
And finally, summation. Why vote for you for this office? We've given people a lot of background, a lot of information, but final pitch, there you go.
Well, I think voters here in Dearborn have a lot of hard choices ahead of them this election, and I think the state reps race is definitely one of them. But what I always think is that voters make their decisions based off of whether or not they think you have experience in the job that you're applying for. And in that case, I can check that box because I have fought for our veterans and gotten a statewide initiative pushed and passed and won. And that's a big accomplishment. And I'm the only candidate in this race who can say that. I think they want to ask, okay, are you authentic, right? Are you somebody who really cares about the issues and who speaks up? And I think that people know through my advocacy, through the Huffington Post, my advocacy as a elected precinct delegate here in Dearborn to the party, that that's true. And then lastly, I think they really just want to know, are you somebody that I like, that I think actually will represent me and is someone like me? And on that, I definitely think that's also the case. And we've had a great response from folks in Dearborn, and I hope that I can earn everybody's vote for this primary.
Well, thank you so much, Brian Stone. Thank you for being on the Journal today, and good luck with your campaign. Finally, maybe you should mention website address for people who want more information. Are you going to be, I know you're in person here today, but any other place out and about in the next week or so people might catch you?
Yes, absolutely. You can go to www.votestone.com to check out my website. We also have a great Facebook page. And then next Sunday at 10 a.m., we'll be at Panera Cares for coffee hours, where anybody who wants to meet me right before the election and chat and say hi, they'll have that opportunity, and it'll be a great informal kind of gathering.
So that's not this Sunday, the 17th, the 24th, or?
Yeah, it's next Sunday.
So it's a week from this Sunday.
Yep.
Gotcha. Okay, he said yes. Okay.
Yeah.
One microphone here going back and forth, folks. But thank you very much, Brian Stone. VoteStone.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's great. So we still got 10 minutes on the show, and I'll cover. Maybe you can do a hug or shake his hand.
Yeah.
Help him out of that chair. And I've got to find my newspapers here. This is the new W. Richard Journal. The station is making waves. Still got a couple more candidates to go. And next week we interview for the same office of 15th District Michigan Rep. Roxanne McDonald, who is a current member of the Board of Education of the Dearborn Public Schools and trustee of Henry Ford College. So she knows where the studio is, at least, because she knows the building, of course. The week after that, again, 2 weeks from today, we're having for the same office, Abdullah Hamoud, a Democrat, and also for 19th District Judge, we're getting our final candidate, Susan DeBaggio, the current president of Dearborn City Council, is running for 19th District Judge, and she also will have her 30 minutes on this show. So it'll be a tightly packed show in 2 weeks. Half an hour for Hamoud and half an hour for DeBaggio. Again, they're running for different offices. But finishing up some details from the papers and things coming up in and around Dearborn here. And I can see this is going to be difficult. Nothing like being out and about in Dearborn. Well, I have to comment, I guess, and that's what we do on the show, about the Dearborn, in the Dearborn Times Herald of this week. I'm looking at Wednesday, July 13th. Today is the 15th. And their top of the page, first page story is something I think it was a story covered before. Back in April, Mayor John O'Reilly Jr.'s son, Devin, was arrested for drunken driving. And at this point, the story says that incident is under investigation for alleged special treatment. Yes, it was a... Now, a drunken driving, there was a collision with a couple of cars other than his own, and the Devin was driving. But it seems that they didn't turn their cameras on as they were giving the sobriety test. The police officer didn't turn their dash cam on when either O'Reilly is removed from his vehicle or performing those field sobriety tests. And so... questions have been raised, of course, by certain people. And it is true that field sobriety tests are usually conducted in front of an officer's vehicle to be recorded on the dash camera. Officers did not follow that procedure. They were aware, admitted, or it was shown on the video that he was the mayor's son at the time. So was there special treatment there? The question has come up, and it's going to be investigated. Although it says in the paper, this is continued on page 8A. Often you have to turn the page, you know, to get the full story. But it says an independent review of the incident is planned by the mayor to analyze the police system for any possible issues with drunken driving arrests. So the mayor is going to be investigating the appropriate investigative procedures for drunken driving
His son, by the way, has gone through the court system and has received his probation sentence and some other requirement for treatment. So that's already been resolved. But the question came up because they didn't have the dash cam footage. I just want to say, I don't know if it's a big issue in the community to other people or not, but they did report it, and certainly we want to have the police having fair and equal procedures for everybody. I think everybody agrees with that in Dearborn and everywhere else in this country, considering events in the last few days, last few weeks, last few months. Let's see what else is going on here. Looking at the press and guide from this last Wednesday. We have a lot of vendors out here at the Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market. Many of them are closing up now because it does end in 4 minutes. And there's a story in the newspaper, actually, about the truck culinary comfort business. A gentleman wanted to start a business, but he couldn't afford to buy a storefront or rent space for residents. So just like some of the vendors out here, they're starting at the farmer's market. He's starting with a truck where he cooks food and he travels around. We have a food truck here. I think they close up at 1:30, so they're leaving here. But several times a week, food trucks also come to the, several times a month, food trucks come to the plaza here between Bryan Library and Buddy's Pizza when there's music and entertainment. I don't have the schedule with me. I don't think there's a performance tonight here. But good luck to the gentleman. He hopes that when he builds up some reputation and support from his truck in various locations, then he can maybe have a permanent location somewhere. So people are finding creative ways to make businesses for themselves, create businesses. And I think that's really great. Thank you. The next major event here, downtown West Dearborn, is not until July 22nd, 5 to 9 p.m. So that next week, Friday? Yes, it is. So, and from 5 to 9 is, they call it a beer garden because some of the food trucks probably sell beer, and they'll have live music. And it looks like on the 22nd, one of the favorite WHFR groups, indie rockers, The Mugs, will be performing here a week from tonight. Not tonight, but there'll be the food trucks, and some will be serving beer, and be fun for all outdoors. Hopefully weather permitting, of course. We want to have a word or two about Concert of Colors. Turning it over to Susan. She's got 3 minutes.
Oh, thank you, Jay. Concert of Colors is the premier world music festival in the city of Detroit. It is tremendous. You will see so much variety of entertainment. My favorite is the outside stage where you get lots of the car thumping, drum type rhythmic music. I love reggae. We're going to see a lot of that this weekend, as well as staples of world music. There's some sort of offshoot type of opportunities to experience the new style music as well. And it's all free. That's the beauty of Concert of Colors. Now, the event officially started yesterday at the DIA, and there's going on throughout the weekend outside of the main venue area, but we're going to be broadcasting Saturday and Sunday, little bit tomorrow and Sunday, at the back of Fisher Music Center. And that's where our portion of the event were heard on the radio station here at 89.3, and we broadcast live from the diversity which is in the little music box portion of the Max Fisher Center. Beautiful venue. It's air-conditioned indoor, of course. You'll find lots of vendors participating, as well as just impromptu performances going on in the lobby, and then the smaller stage that we'll broadcast on, and then, of course, inside the orchestra hall itself. So lots of opportunities to really expand your interest in your musical experience. In addition, might want to bring a little bit of extra cash. I always like to buy a little something down there. There's beautiful street vendors. There's great food for sale, as well as, again, just a lot of like-minded people supporting the kind of diversity in our beautiful community. And, again, it's all food.
Yes, we hope to see you down there, because we're going to have a table in the lobby, as well as big broadcasting, as Susan said, from the music box. We named the Comerica Diversity Stage. Two great stages, luxurious facility. If you haven't been down to the Maxon Fisher Center, traffic and parking around there is, well, parking is still in the same places, but since they're putting the M1 rail in, Woodward is kind of closed down to one lane each way. So allow a little extra time. Actually, the Maxon Fisher people are recommending that you actually use Cass, which is the street that runs north-south, just parallel to Woodward, on just west of Woodward, just one street over, and then Cass will get you to the Maxon Fisher Center. I think it's between Selden and Parsons, but they've taken down the street sign for those streets. But from Cass, you'll see the back of the Maxon Fisher complex is actually the School for the Performing Arts. You'll see their big logo sign, and then you know just park in a nearby lot around there, and it's just, you just have to walk over to Woodward, and the entrance to Maxon Fisher is there.
Opens at 1.
Opens at 1, yeah. We didn't use the hours. I meant it opens at 1 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday and goes till 10 o'clock at night. Music on both stages, indoors and outdoors, throughout this. So a lot of free entertainment, great for families, and there's food indoors as well as out, as Susan mentioned. So we better say goodbye for now, because Highway 61 is about to get started. So thanks for listening to the new WHFR Journal. Thanks to all of our guests. Thanks to Susan McGraw for sharing the seat with me, since John Conroy is out of town this week. And be careful out there.